Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Biasplaining Podcast. This is part two of my conversation with Todd Harwell. Todd is doing amazing research looking into the contributions of the LGBTQ plus community in the citizen and community science space. In this next part of the conversation, Todd and I get down to talking about advice. So Todd has some advice for researchers at all ages and all stages in their careers, but he makes some really good points concerning younger researchers and grad students about things to look out for if they are queer themselves and really putting themselves first in terms of ensuring that the research that they're doing and the space they're doing the research in is optimal and supportive and welcoming in a safe space. Todd unfortunately had a pretty bad experience where he had to switch PhD supervisors halfway through because although the lab was highly regarded and so was the PI, he didn't feel like it was a very inclusive and welcoming and safe space for him. So I hope you enjoy this next part of my conversation with Todd. Again, I'm trying to firm up my podcast hosting and interviewing skills, so apologies if I sort of ramble on a bit. I'm trying to work on it and make the best product and listening experience possible for my audience. Here we go.
I have like sort of a series of questions that are very similar to each other, but one thing I like to ask of all my guests is like sort of like an advice segment. So if you could look back to your past self, like maybe post manatee stuffed animal, but like, do you have any advice for your past self or for students at a particular age? So I want to start with, if you have any advice for like just undergrad students, like what would you tell yourself or undergrad students if they asked you for any sort of career or life advice? It could be sort of anything you would feel would be helpful to them to know.
Yeah, I'd say undergrads, like especially, you know, queer undergrads, you know, pursue opportunities that are going to allow you to thrive, like personally, as well as professionally and academically. So, you know, find, if you want grad school, find a supervisor that's like fully supportive of you as a whole complex, unique individual, and is going to support you in any way that they can. And same with like a professional work environment, like only go where you're valued. Don't put yourself back in the closet for the sake of your career or your studies, because that's going to have long-term negative impacts on your mental and emotional well-being, and it's just not worth it.
Can I ask a supplemental question? So obviously fantastic advice, and I would wholeheartedly agree, but sometimes we don't know what we're getting ourselves into vis-a-vis going back in the closet, right? So are there any red flags or how would one go about assessing if a place could be sort of a safe space where they can be their authentic self? Because as we all know, you know, when you're sort of shopping around and checking out research opportunities in grad school, you don't have like 6 months to hang out to figure out if you like it. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned firsthand is that basically very, very, very few prospective grad students put the time in to actually try to like network or meet professors. It's more like, I'm going to throw out these applications and like the first person that accepts me, I'm going to just go and figure out the rest of this crazy PhD or MSc career as I go. So I mean, I don't know if you have an answer, but in your experience, would there be any sort of like red flags to maybe look for to think like, wait, this isn't maybe a good place for, you know, a young queer scientist?
Yeah. I think, yeah, I totally understand. It's also, it's exhausting, like continually outing yourself on a daily basis. So I guess like the best thing, like look for red flags, like, you know, if pay attention to the language that's used, like both like people speaking to you as well as, you know, online, like, are they only using he, she in a job description? Are they using like very gendered language? Like, oh, you guys, like, and kind of like looking for those kind of like social cues. And then also, you know, physically in physical spaces, like, are there gender neutral restrooms? Like, are there, you know, initiatives to support that? Cause like, even, you know, I'm a cisgender man, but still, if I see a gender neutral restroom, like I see that, you know, effort is being made to be welcoming and inclusive in a safe space for, you know, LGBTQ plus folks. So, kind of like falling into that community, I automatically feel like a stronger sense of comfort. In addition to that, just do your research, ask about like resources, affinity groups, special interest groups, and like any other like like groups of support that, or resources that might be made available based on, you know, various aspects of your being.
So that sort of segues into the next one. It's slightly different. Grad students, what would you say to grad students? Such a loaded subject. Anything and everything you would recommend, good or bad, what would you tell, you know, first day grad school students, if you have any advice?
If you come across red flags, pay attention to them. I'm speaking from my own experience, kind of, you know, switching PhD advisors halfway through. For a long time ignored the red flags because, you know, this person was a great researcher, a great, could have been a great resource and mentor, but just, you know, look for, again, people that are going to value you, invest in you, and like really want to build you up, rather than make themselves look good or for you to provide them with good data.
Yeah. And I'm also surprised, like similarly, how long it takes a lot of students to realize, like, I have a very cynical view of the science world, but like how long it takes a lot of students to realize that, like, you're really there to collect data for someone else. Like, you're doing your own research, but in the end, your PI is getting the publications also. And it's not really like, it's about your own career development, but in the end, like, grad students are probably the cheapest exploitable labor there is. And so, but a lot of us are sort of like in that denial, or, and it doesn't have to be like a bad thing, but I just think it, we have this like mask of like, I'm a scientist, I don't have feelings, I'm just here to do great work. Mm-hmm. And then you realize like, wait a minute, my PI isn't necessarily available, or there's way too much work, or it's kind of exploitative, or like, there's not a lot of work-life balance. And I don't feel like I can, you know, have a fulfilling sort of existence as a scientist. And it's like, you're right. Like, you pay attention to those flags, because like I didn't, and it did some damage. So I think that's a really good point. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Okay. So similarly, let's just say like PhD postdocs. So I guess the distinction is like, you know, you're either sort of at the tail end of a PhD, or you're exploring potentially postdocing, or like the next phase of academia, or thinking about, you know, leaving academia entirely. Like, so I guess advice for someone in your own shoes, like, what would you say?
I'd say, like, nowadays with this job market, just be open, be flexible, and, you know, look at everything. Yeah. That's what I'm doing. You know, I'm looking for anything and everything that excites me and I feel like would be a good fit, between, you know, postdocing, academia, industry, to like more education, outreach, nonprofit, startup, like honestly everything. you know, again, like I personally, I'm all about like being valued and like, you know, that kind of reciprocal relationship of like, you know, I have something to offer, but also I'm being appreciated for my work. And so I'd say put that above a title, an institution prestige, a PI name, put yourself above all of that and prioritize like yourself.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's awesome. Okay, so I know I said there was four questions, but we can do three. That's good.
Okay.
But then I want to actually circle back, because I realized that I didn't do the best job of asking you about your actual research. So can we like go back a bit? And I actually want to know more about sort of specifically what you studied. Like, did you study a number of citizen science projects? Were they in a specific sort of field? What were some findings? Like, just if you can tell a little bit of a story about that work, because I think it's super interesting, and I would love to hear more about it.
Yeah, so I'm finishing writing my dissertation, like, as we speak. I mean, I'm not typing right in this moment, but the document's minimized right now. but yeah, so for, like, my dissertation, it's kind of got, like, two main phases. So in my first phase, I actually did a survey of citizen science practitioners. So The folks that lead, manage, oversee, design citizen science projects and programs or community science programs. And I was curious to kind of like hear from them about like, what do you and your programs do to develop science identities and build community of your volunteers in general? I didn't specifically limit it to LGBT plus volunteers because again, like not that sort of data is usually not tracked, especially like by a program. I did try to like ask them if they knew of any. I got a little bit of data on that, which was interesting. But then kind of like my next phase is I actually set out and interviewed 14 in total queer identifying citizen and community science volunteers about their experiences with citizen and community science. And specifically, I was interested in, you know, how there were overlaps between kind of the aspects related to science identities, like we were talking about earlier, and aspects of their queer identities. And then also same thing with community, like trying to figure out like if they felt like their group of volunteers or their those involved with their project were, if they felt a sense of community and connection with them. And then like where, like what, basically what community means to them and like what could make citizen science opportunities feel more like community.
So are you able to like disclose any of that, or is this like, I mean, it's being typed up, so I don't know if you can, but like
yeah.
At a high level, are there any learnings that you could share, even though it's like preprint kind of thing?
Yeah. So, in terms of like the survey, like practitioners, and like how they feel they develop identity and community among volunteers, kind of what I was getting at about the, like being a science person, like it's not just like if you consider yourself one, but if others kind of like reinforce that to you.
Yeah.
So citizen science practitioners like try to do that. They try to like, you know, reinforce like you're doing science, you are a scientist,
right.
But they don't know if their volunteers consider themselves scientists. Like they're not getting that sort of,
right.
they're not assessing or evaluating, getting that feedback of like, you know, what are those personal outcomes? Like, how are you feeling about it? So like from the, you know, the top down, they're like, yeah, we're doing these things, but we don't know if it's like sticking, if, you know, if people are feeling empowered with the science that they're doing and recognizing that, which is kind of interesting. And then it, a big aspect of building community among volunteers, all volunteers, not just queer folks, is multiple opportunities for interaction and engagement. So, you know, not just having one training event, but, you know, having opportunities for volunteers to be in contact. So whether that's like a project Facebook group, I heard of like specific like Discord servers where project volunteers can interact, not, and it's not limited to the context of the project, but also just like socialize and get to know one another. Not only does that help build community, it also helps with volunteer retention. It keeps people engaged in the project if like they're connecting with other people, which is pretty cool.
That's awesome. So, oh, sorry, go on. I have like the worst talking over people habit ever. So it's only going to get better.
No, you're here. Good. I was just going to kind of shift to my interviews, which is kind of the data I'm working on now. You know, I interviewed 14 of them and I think 8 felt like their queer identity didn't negatively impact their experience with citizen science or didn't really impact their engagement one way or another. And in those cases, they were largely doing projects where they collected data on their own. So doing like beach monitoring or like water quality sampling. So it's just kind of the nature of the project was kind of more solitary endeavors.
Right.
Whereas those that engaged in kind of larger groups totally like do not feel a sense of community. They don't feel a sense of connection with other folks. They don't necessarily, like some of them mentioned, they don't feel comfortable like outing themselves to folks.
Right.
Because again, you don't know like how people are going to react, if they're going to be like welcoming or open.
Right.
So yeah, still like being in a group with like similar interests and like a same driven purpose, but still feeling othered, feeling like an outsider, you know, multiple cases of that.
Do you think there's like a scale effect? Like, is there perhaps like a magic number of people? Because you were saying that the first group who didn't feel like their citizen science activities negatively affected their self-identity as queer people. Mm-hmm. But you said most of those activities were sort of more solitary. So do you think there's like maybe a magic number of people in one of these citizen science groups where it becomes like a little more alienating, like an alienating number of like, is it a group of like three? Is it a group of 20? I don't know if you have that data, but it just occurred to me.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I think it kind of comes back to that opportunity for engagement right. because, you know, some of the folks that were doing kind of these solitary endeavors, they did express that they wish they could know what other people were doing or have some sort of connection to them. So kind of like opportunities to exchange and interact would be like appreciated. And I think, you know, if those sorts of kind of communication channels or platforms kind of were made available, then there's more opportunity for, you know, people to build community, to potentially, you know, find somebody with some like shared aspect of identity that they might feel that connection with, and, you know, potentially even, you know, find other queer folks involved in the project that they didn't even know existed.
Right, definitely. And the second, I guess, sort of part I want to ask about that is, did you find similar trends about people's science identities in terms of their responses? Like, did people feel like they were still recognizing themselves as science, or was there something in the way that maybe the group dynamic, or like how did their science identities sort of track with like their queer acceptance is not the right word, but I think you know what I'm trying to say. Like, did you see similar trends in terms of how they perceive themselves as scientists?
Yeah, it's, I might've gotten lost with the question. I apologize.
No, it's on me. I guess I'm interested as well in like, did you see similar results, or what were your results like about or around the development of the science identity? So not necessarily
right.
the representation and welcoming, I can't speak, that's not a word, the support for queer people, but like, did you notice anything unusual or have any observations about the reflection of that scientific identity towards these participants?
Yeah, it was interesting because, you know, they kind of, it emerged kind of both positive and negative kind of aspects related to science identities based on different experiences. So, more positive were kind of, you know, reflecting on how they first engaged in science, like family influence was actually a huge one, where majority of participants, you know, having families that engaged them with science in some way was mostly positive. I had one participant that had negative family influence. But then there's a lot of value in kind of, there's a lot of overlap between kind of science identity and community. So
yeah.
Another thing that emerged was like friendships and relationships, you know, having somebody to share, you know, your science with, whether it's like doing the activities directly or just being able to like talk to them about what you're doing. So having those sorts of connections.
Here I go interrupting people again.
And then, no, you're good. It was really interesting because like, in my kind of questioning about science identity, a lot of folks mentioned that they felt like citizen science attracts a lot of queer people. Like they're like, just kind of anecdotally, you're like, they're like, oh, it's interesting because, you know, I feel like it's an environment that like welcomes or attracts this group. I heard awesome. Through the grapevine, I don't know if you're familiar with iNaturalist. It's like
yeah.
a huge, yeah, huge. Online like citizen science platform. But apparently there's like an unofficial iNaturalist Discord server.
Oh, sweet.
And multiple of the people I interviewed are like engaged in that server, and they say it skews like towards queer population.
Queer population.
They're like, yeah. I don't know what it is, but most people on the Discord server, it's like open to everyone queer. Affiliated with iNaturalist. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like the queers taking over iNaturalist. That's amazing.
Right.
That's so interesting. So just to recap, like, I think that's so awesome you pointed that out, because I keep thinking, how can we go about proactively building scientific entities? So you said You know, you want to have a lot of opportunities for engagement. Family influence was a huge thing, which makes sense because when I think about like my own story and colleagues of mine, a lot of them had either people in sciences or there was like a heavy appreciation of science as like a career path. And then also just friendships and relationships, which is, I think, super important because, I mean, I like my best friend I met in grad school, I think the relationships that you build in scientific environments can be really, really just beneficial and long lasting. And yeah, and I naturalist. So I was wondering if there's any like specific community science projects that you worked on, but I guess if you're mentioning iNaturalist, I answer that question. I'm wondering if do you know Zooniverse?
Yeah.
So Zooniverse, like, I don't know if you've, have you interacted with anyone from that community in your research?
I think a couple of my participants contributed to Zooniverse projects. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'm a big fan of that too. It's not necessarily all like naturalist work, but it's also very cool, like crowdsourcing of science. And really like really interesting little tasks to do. Very cool. That's so fantastic. Oh, this has been so fantastic. Yeah, I'm just so glad to talk to you about this and understand more of like how we can develop more scientific identities in people and how we can appreciate people's contributions. And it's interesting that you say sort of like anecdotally you found out that citizen science sort of attracts or queer people, and I wonder if maybe it's because they sort of inherently feel seen because it's a very like frictionless entry into science. Like they don't have to go to school, they don't have to be in these institutions, they don't have to like enroll really in a, like a long bureaucratic process, and they can just do it. Have you ever, did you ever come across opportunities or feedback situations where you're interviewing these people and they're just like so ignited by science now and they want to like go off to do science like legitimately?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like the folks I talked to, you know, some of the, I'd say one or two were like, you know, on a trajectory, like they want to pursue like science professionally or as a career. But interestingly, a lot of them have been engaged in citizen and community science as like from a leader, from a practitioner role. So like their initial engagement as a volunteer has led them to kind of like deepen their involvement and engagement to now design projects, to lead projects, to incorporate it and incorporate citizen and community science into their teaching in a classroom. And so they're really like leveraging, you know, their experience as a volunteer to now get others engaged in other science opportunities, which I think is something really interesting and kind of something I have earmarked for future research is kind of looking at the relationship between having different roles in citizen science, you know, the perspective of a volunteer versus that of like a leader and kind of like looking at that. And then especially, you know, multiple of the 14 queer folks that I talked to kind of like getting at that too. If there's some sort of relationship or influence going on there.
That's awesome. That's great. So these, so there are real opportunities for volunteers to grow and develop into leadership positions, which leads them just further into getting involved with science.
Right.
Undoubtedly probably enhances their scientific illiteracy. Sorry, I was going to say illiteracy. Literacy, not the illiteracy part. and just leads them onto paths of more involvement. That's so awesome.
And that is a wrap for part two of my conversation with Todd Harwell. Todd is a PhD candidate studying the contributions of the LGBTQ/queer community in citizen and community science projects. We had a great conversation talking all about authenticity, representation, and the ability of scientists and researchers to be their true authentic selves within the broader scientific community. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. Please don't hesitate to reach out. You can find me a number of ways. The best way is probably to email us at biosplainingpodcast@gmail.com. That's biosplaining podcast@gmail.com. You can find me on LinkedIn and Twitter as well. On LinkedIn, my name is Ira, I-R-A. My last name is S-H-E-R-R. I know it's like phonetically really weird to understand, so I apologize for that. I also write under Coach Bio if it's easier to look up that way. Similarly, you can find me on Twitter at Ira Share with the same spelling. If you want to get in touch with Todd Harwell, he would love to hear from you as well. You could find him on LinkedIn, Todd A. Harwell. His last name is H-A-R-W-E-L-L. And in the show notes, I'm going to drop the link to the AAAS article, which is the article I read about Todd in the first place. I think it's really informative and interesting and would be awesome for anyone to read if you've enjoyed this episode. Music, edits, and everything to do with the audio of today's episode was done by the mighty Fred Brenton. The Biosplinning logo and visual identity was done by Gio Petrucci. And last but not least, I just want to say thank you so much for tuning into the episode. I know the podcast ecosystem is extremely competitive and gets more and more saturated every single day, so I really appreciate you listening. If you wanted to like, subscribe, tell your friends, that would be fantastic and helps us grow the audience so we can keep bringing you great content. Thanks a lot for listening, and I hope to see you next time.